This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When asked what she does for a living, Elizabeth Pisani sometimes answers sex and drugs. The more precise answer is that she's an epidemiologist who has spent years investigating the spread of the AIDS epidemic. She's provided research, analysis, and policy advice to UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the Centers for Disease Control. Her new book is called The Wisdom of Whores: Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. As we'll hear later, one of the subjects she writes about is President Bush's program PEPFAR, an acronym for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. President Bush described it as a work of mercy to help the people of Africa. But the financial aid comes with strings attached that Pisani says reflect a moral agenda, not an epidemiological one. Elizabeth Pisani, welcome to Fresh Air. Just give us a brief overview of the work that you've done as an epidemiologist working on the AIDS epidemic around the world.
Well, most of my work has been focused on trying to help governments understand how the HIV virus is spreading in their countries. And in the countries that I've worked in, which are mostly in Asia, so Indonesia, in China, in East Timor, in the Philippines and other countries, that means spending a lot of time hanging out in brothels because we work a lot with commercial sex workers and men who buy sex. Also with gay men in nightclubs and injection drug users. So I spend a lot of time having very late nights.
Give us an example of something you learned about how AIDS was spread by sex workers in one of the countries that you work in that you wouldn't have known had you not really been there on the ground talking to people directly.
We always have this assumption that sex workers have huge numbers of partners. And when we were talking to some of the sex workers in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, where I worked for many years, they actually reported very low numbers of partners. And in fact, that taught us more about the science than it did about the sex work itself, because I was sitting around, in fact, one evening with one of the transgender sex workers, and we were chatting and drinking, and she was knocking back my very best whiskey. And I was like, Ines, you've got expensive tastes. How do you support that on 3 clients a week? And she said, what do you mean 3 clients a week? And I said, well, that's what you're telling us in your surveys. And she said, nah, you're talking to all the dogs. And I said, no, we're not. We're doing random selection, very by the book, great epidemiological surveys. And she said, nah, you're talking to all the dogs. And I was like, you're not listening to me, Ines. We do these random. And she interrupts me again and says, no, any sex worker who's talking to a research team is a sex worker who's not with a client. So you're talking to all the dogs. You're talking to the ones who are not with clients. And therefore, you're getting, she didn't put it this way, but you're biasing your estimates downwards. And in fact, as a result of that, we changed the way that we did our samplings, and we got much higher reports of clients later on. So you learn a lot from being on the ground and chatting to the people that you're working with.
What did you change?
What we did was we worked with the structures. The transgender sex trade is very, very interesting. It's very well structured, and it has a structure that almost exactly mirrors the government structures of Indonesia. So you have a provincial head, a district head, and then a head for each of the sub-districts, and they organize the girls and all of the girls, I call them, transgender sex workers, and all of them are very careful to work in a hierarchy and do what the district head says. So we started working with the district heads in the transgender community, and they gathered people during the daytime when we weren't interrupting with working hours to their houses, and we were able to do the surveys there. So not only did it make it easier for the transgenders because we weren't interrupting their work, but it also made it easier for my research team because we didn't have to be on the streets at 2:30 in the morning, subject to police raids, for example. It's very embarrassing when your whole survey team gets taken away by the police because they're accused of being sex workers.
Right. You write in your book that the AIDS epidemic in Africa is different in how it's spread than the AIDS epidemic in most other countries. What's different about Africa?
Essentially, there are two epidemics in the world. One is, as you say, in East and Southern Africa particularly, and one is in all of the rest of the world. So the United States looks more like Indonesia, looks more like Argentina, looks more like Kyrgyzstan than it does like any African nation. The difference is this, that in most of the world, HIV is spread mostly in behaviors that are fairly well defined as high risk, and that is among people who buy and sell sex, among gay men who have many partners, and among people who inject drugs. In Africa, because of different patterns of sexual behavior, HIV spreads among men and women in the general population. And the different patterns of sexual behavior are this. It's not a volume question. It's not Africans have more sex. It's that they have sex in different patterns. And that is, they're more likely to have two or three partners at any given time, in any given six-month period, than people in other parts of the world. People in other parts of the world may have the same number of partners overall, or probably more over the course of a lifetime, but they tend to have them in a string, in a serial monogamy pattern. So I call it sex in nets versus sex in strings. Why is that important? Because HIV is actually not very infectious. So it's a virus that, once it gets into your body, replicates very, very, very quickly. And there's lots of virus hanging around in your body. And for that period, you are highly infectious. But that period only lasts for a maximum of 2 or 3 months. Some would say up to 6 months maximum. And then you start making antibodies, and it controls the amount of HIV that's in your body and that can easily be passed on. And that phase can go on for a very long time, but you're not in that phase, not very infectious. So the likelihood that you spread HIV essentially depends on how many partners you have in that first very infectious period.
You're of two minds when it comes to President Bush's AIDS funding program in Africa. You're very supportive and upbeat about the treatment aspects of the funding, the funding that's used for treatment programs, but you're very critical of how the funding is used for prevention.
The progress that has been made on treatment has been absolutely astonishing worldwide. And it's really because the United States and President Bush, through this PEPFAR program, as it's called, upped the ante. When we first made the estimates of how much it would cost to beat this thing worldwide, we didn't even put treatment into the equation because everyone just thought, you know, it's just never going to happen in Africa. We can't even be dreaming of it. And 3 or 4 years later, the United States government said, why shouldn't we be thinking of it? Of course we can think of it, and put the money on the table. And it changed everything. And that's been absolutely wonderful and really made a dramatic difference to the lives of now close to 3 million people who are living with the virus and who are now able to access treatment. But the more treatment you have, the more prevention you need, because it increases the size of the epidemic by keeping people alive for longer. So we really need to refocus on prevention. But the money that has been provided through PEPFAR is peculiarly ineffective for prevention because of the restrictions that have been placed on it. And those are the following. Of the money that's earmarked for prevention, a third of it has in the past been earmarked for abstinence-only programs. Now, abstinence-only programs have been heavily funded in the United States, and they've been shown not to work even in the United States. Of the teenagers who take an abstinence pledge, who actually stand up in public and say, I will abstain from sex until I'm married, we have a failure rate of at least 72%. That's among the people who actually take the pledge. Forget about those who don't. Why we think that those programs would be any more effective in East and Southern Africa than they are, or anywhere else in the world than they are in the United States, I've never been able to fathom. The second restriction, which is a very important one, is on working effectively in the commercial sex trade. The United States government at the moment takes an abolitionist view to the sex trade. The only way to deal with prostitution is to wipe it out entirely. Now, many of us believe that that's not a feasible answer, and that what we need to do is to increase health and safety conditions for workers and for clients in the sex trade. But we can't do that effectively with PEPFAR money. It's not allowed.
In fact, in countries that take AIDS funding for prevention from the United States, they have to sign a pledge. What does the pledge say?
The pledge says that we will not, as an organization, or if it's a national government, as a country, recognize commercial sex as an industry or a legitimate activity, and that we will not engage in anything that promotes commercial sex or recognizes it in that way. Now, that makes it very, very difficult to work effectively with sex worker rights organizations. It makes it very difficult to work with the structures of the sex industry. I think I mentioned earlier that some of the most effective programs have been when we work with brothels and when we work with sex workers directly. And you can't do that.
You know, you mentioned that in the Bush-funded program, when it comes to prevention, that the programs have to be abstinence only, and countries and organizations that accept money have to sign an oath saying that they oppose the practice of prostitution and that they have no intention of using any American money for prevention programs related to sex work. How did those...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Of using any money, not even any American money.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The government is currently being sued. Yes, the government of the United States is currently being sued by two organizations who contend that it restricts their freedom of speech because they're not allowed to use even their own money to do those activities.
Well, how do these
unless they sign the pledge?
How do these restrictions end up in AIDS funding from U.S. money?
They were part of a bill that was passed by Congress in 2003, and the restrictions were written into the bill. Now, that bill was passed by a Republican Congress. The bill is now being considered for reauthorization under a Democrat-controlled Congress. Some of the restrictions have been removed. The abstinence-only earmark has been removed, but some have stayed, including the prostitution, anti-prostitution oath. I think that many people are deeply disappointed by that and would like to see that change before the money is actually reallocated.
My guest is Elizabeth Pisani. She's an epidemiologist and author of the new book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elizabeth Pisani. She's an epidemiologist who has provided research analysis and policy advice to UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the CDC about HIV and the spread of HIV. She's the author of the new book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. You know, you write in your book about how politics around the world has so often interfered with the effective prevention of HIV, of the spread of HIV. Give us a couple of what you consider to be the most frequent ways that politics prevents what you would consider to be the best epidemiological ways of preventing the spread of HIV.
The most obvious example is drug injection. The United States taxpayer has funded, at my last count, I think 17 comprehensive reviews of the evidence on harm reduction, and 17 out of 17 have concluded that it is effective and that it is also cost effective. And yet we are still not allowed to use any federal money to provide clean needles to drug injectors. And this is, you know, that's a U.S. thing, but we see it in numerous other countries. We've been fighting very, very hard to get HIV prevention into prisons because we know that people in prisons both inject drugs and have unprotected sex. That's very risky. And people don't want to support that. And when you talk to, I remember talking to a friend in Indonesia who is from Bali, and he was he's been living with HIV for many years now, and he's like, yeah, I remember exactly when it happened. I was in jail, and someone gave us a bunch of, we got a bunch of heroin in through one of the guards, and we had one syringe, and so we voted, we designated one guy the injector, and we all lined up, and there were 26 of us lined up. And I was number 23 in the line. And he shot up the first person, and he shot up the second person, and there's blood all over the place, and he rinsed the needle under a dirty tap, and then he shot up the next person and the next person, and then it got to number 12, and I was thinking, all I could think was, please let there be some drugs left. Please let there be some drugs left. He's not thinking, you know, I'm going to get infected with a disease, that needle is disgusting. He's thinking, please let there be some drugs left. And this, my friend Frankie said to me, you know, I can't believe now that I was so stupid, but boy, does addiction make you stupid. Yes, it makes you stupid, but does that mean that we should punish you for being stupid, or could we possibly try and keep you alive until you stop being an addict? Those very, very pragmatic approaches to addiction and to risky sex are things that are not necessarily supported by the majority of voters, and therefore are not supported by the majority of governments.
A lot of people who have AIDS now, and I think this is probably particularly true in developed countries, you know, in countries like England, where you live, in the United States, a lot of people who have HIV are on the new drugs, and people with AIDS are living living with it as a very difficult but chronic condition, as opposed to a life sentence. So, how is that affecting, do you think, the spread of HIV, and how often people are actually following safe sex practices? You know, now that AIDS isn't the death sentence that it once was.
The effect of this treatment is that we're decoupling the HIV epidemic from the AIDS epidemic. You can live with HIV without ever seeing AIDS. We are now seeing a whole generation of young people, and we're seeing it most obviously in the gay communities in the United States. We're seeing a whole generation of young gay men who have never seen AIDS. So for them, HIV is this sort of slightly mythical thing that they've heard about and they know is supposed to, you know, be horrible, but actually people are thinking of it almost now as an inconvenience. You take your medicines, you'll be fine. And when you look at the advertising that drug companies do directly to the consumer, and you see the guys who are on AIDS meds and they're all, you know, abseiling down canyons against a sunset or whatever, you think, yeah, it doesn't look so scary.
Now, so how is this affecting safe sex?
Well, we've got quite a bit of evidence from gay communities in industrial countries, including the United States, that condom use is falling and that unprotected sex is rising. Now, people are getting a bit cleverer about who they have sex with, so you're seeing a lot more unprotected sex between people who are already infected. But we're also seeing a rise in unprotected sex between people who don't know the other person's HIV status. And that's really very, very worrying. If we see that same effect in Africa, now that this extremely generous program from the United States and many other countries is increasing treatment dramatically in Africa, then we're going to have a very, very big problem. Because what we're doing is, by getting rid of AIDS through treatment, without getting rid of HIV, we're removing the fear, we're reducing the incentive to stay safe, to adopt safer behaviors. That means more people infected with HIV, and that means even more people who are going to be on these treatments. The treatments are expensive. The price is coming down all the time, but they remain expensive. And because HIV is a virus that replicates very, very, very quickly, it also develops resistance very quickly. We don't know how long these drugs are going to be effective for. So it's really a very, very big risk, both financially and in terms of the ongoing spread of the disease.
So you're looking at a possible nightmare, the dimensions of which we don't know yet.
I would say
a new form of the nightmare.
That's right. And it's a form of the nightmare that no one is talking about.
Elizabeth Pisani, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Pisani is the author of the new book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.